the city, back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match head.
Okay, so I am here once again with China Mieval, most recently the author of The City and the City. China, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here again. I want to, first of all, figure out exactly when you wrote this book, because I know that you wrote it for your mother, but I am very curious because the time frame of this book is quite interesting. The first 100 pages, it could almost be in the late 90s, because we have a lot of references to, for example, PDAs and technology of the time in various rickety forms. And then in the last 200 pages, we start seeing references to MySpace and iPods and the like. And not only that, but there's a difference between that 100-page mark between the compact nature of the description in the prose versus the dialogue-driven nature of the last 200 pages. So I'm curious to figure out what the time frame was in terms of writing this whole thing, first and foremost. And second of all, I mean, this novel could essentially take place, even in this parallel timeline, at any point in the last 10 years. So I'm curious if you can kind of cobble together all these stray bits of inquiry into one cohesive answer, as you usually do.
No, that's very perspicacious. I mean, it was all written in the last two years, but part of the reason that there's that shift that you talk about is because the first third of the book is set in a city that is struggling to keep up technologically and economically, basically. And so, you know, I wanted to give the sense of it being a modern city, but a slightly shambolic modern city, a modern city that, you know, sort of is, you know, maybe doesn't quite have the latest iteration of the software, you know, that sort of thing. And then later on, there's a move to a more economically advanced and technologically advanced city, and so things kind of speed up and you get all the all the other stuff. So, you know, they're still using dial-up in the first third of the book, which is, you know, relatively rare these days in Britain, and then you might move to the broadband in the second in the second third. But it is, I mean, it's intended to be now. It was completed just really before all the kind of economic catastrophe. So I suppose to some extent the second two thirds of the book, which are set around a kind of economically vibrant place, maybe if you went back to that city or Coma now, it would be they would be having their own problems, because it's the kind of economy that would be very severely hit by what's been going on. But it is intended to be, you know, here and now, sort of, well, maybe a year and a half ago, 2 years ago.
Yeah, but simultaneously, you do have non-passengers go to the airport terminals and onto the planes, and so this leads me to believe that in this parallel timeline, September 11th didn't happen.
Well, no, September 11th did happen, but, you know, not all, you know, different countries respond differently, and each country has its own rules and so on, and, you know, it may be that, you know, it's a good point, perhaps. Perhaps the U.S. State Department would have words with with the Bechel authorities about the ability to go on the plane for the cops. But in this world, this is a, you know, it's an independent city state that has its own laws and stuff. But it is intended to be, you know, I mean, there's these rather kind of not sterile but quite sort of scholastic debates about whether or not a particular book is set in the real world, but in an invented place in the real world, which is kind of a meaningless argument to me. I mean, certainly the intention is to be a city that is just round the corner from things that one knows in the edge of Europe. Yeah. It is not, you know, intended to be, you know, it's intended to feel much more familiar, even if slightly uneasily semi-familiar.
Yeah, but what I was thinking of when I was reading this was, of course, reports of certain events in London in which you have the streets meshing into each other. This seems to me very similar to the unseen nature of these two cities next to each other, having the cross-hatch areas and the like, and I'm curious if that particular story possibly was a prototype of this intersection of two completely different disparate urban areas conjoining like this. This is kind of a sort of warm-up possibly for this, that this had been in your mind for some years? Or?
I would have at least at a conscious level, because these questions, you can only ever answer about what's going on consciously, which of course is only one, you know, it's an iceberg, isn't it? And, you know, the bulk of it's going on without your knowledge. At a conscious level, I would say not particularly, because, and we're very much into spoiler territory here, so I would say if anyone is interested in reading the book, I personally think, you know, we can't really talk about this without talking about the nature of the cities and it's not like a huge spoiler, but there is an attempt to develop that over the first five chapters of the book so that you kind of come to realize the nature of the place where you are. So I would encourage people to read those chapters before listening to this. So having said that as a warning, you know, the big difference between this and reports of certain events in London is the nature of the fantastic. The thing about The City and the City is that The City and the City is an attempt to kind of take the, rather than it being, you know, dimensional shift and magic and all that sort of thing, although there's hints and there's, you know, sort of playing with the possibility, but fundamentally what this is about is taking the logic of everyday borders, the logic of political boundaries, and extrapolating them just a little tiny bit. But the logic is the same. It's an exaggeration, but it's not a radical break. So in terms of, you know, the rules of physics and all that sort of stuff, you know, it is at least, you know, 96% sure that they are the same as in this world here. Sure. You know, this is not a kind of magical realm in that sense. That's not how this works. And that's quite a big difference, because that short story was very much about a kind of, you know, the kind of implicit dream logic of sort of the psychogeography of London, and sort of literalizing that metaphor and sort of, you know, the city as a kind of uneasy beast sort of thing. This is slightly different. In some ways, this is much more to do with, you know, the kind of genuine juridical, legal, political reality of the world. It's extrapolated, but to that extent, it's very realistic. The logic of the strangeness is actually a logic that exists in the real world. It's a little bit exaggerated, but that's all. So for me, they feel quite different, but that's not to invalidate your point, because like I say, it's as much to do with reception and subconscious stuff, but at a conscious level, they felt quite different to me.
Yeah, but you're also dealing with a conceptual framework here with the two cities, mm-hmm. and this leads me to wonder, since of course, the last time we talked, and you've talked repeatedly about your notion of monsters, and of course, the way your imagination works is very much kind of extending on into in creating this giant world to go ahead and play in. Here you have a situation in which, from a dialogue standpoint, just on that alone, you are now dealing with procedural dialogue, as opposed to what we have seen in your previous books, in which you have dialogue that is very, like, you know, very intense and yeah. melodramatic, because, of course, there are giant monsters that are terrorizing a landscape and ripping things up. And, of course, people are going to want to get other people's attention in this. Yeah. But I'm yeah. curious if going to this procedural dialogue was a bit of a challenge, because you had to possibly restrain the natural inventiveness that definitely crops up both in the dialogue as well as in the narrative, or if the conceptual framework was just enough for to kind of even things out, or if there were any difficulties in the procedural dialogue whatsoever.
Well, it didn't feel difficult. Now, that's not to say it's done well. I mean, I'm not the right person to judge. You know, it's up to readers to say, you know, they might be saying, well, of course it didn't feel difficult because you totally fucked it up. You know, I mean, I don't know. But for me, can I swear? Sorry.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay, you can say whatever the hell you want.
All right.
Or fuck you want, there you go.
Okay. But no, in the writing, it didn't feel difficult, because it's very much, for me, it's always a question of kind of trying to get into the voice at the start. So it wasn't a question, like, I don't think I have so much a kind of default voice as people possibly think, because the Baslag books have quite a strong kind of baroque meandering narrative voice, and yeah. so that's obviously what I'm known for, and I understand that, but I think it's more a question of each of those voices was kind of got into as part of the project. And so for this, because this was always a book that was conceived of as a noir set in what is brackets very very nearly close brackets the real world, it felt completely different from the word go. And so people asked the same question about On London, you know, did it feel difficult to get into a slightly more playful, child-friendly voice? No, because that's the mode you're in when you're starting the writing, you know. Yeah. So I was reading a lot of noir, I was reading a lot of crime, I was thinking in that sense, I was thinking in terms of telling a story to my mum, who read a lot of books like that, and so that was the voice that demanded. So it didn't, no, it wasn't a question of kind of reining yourself in. It was a question of indulging the voice that you had got into for this job, yeah. if that makes sense. So.
But still, you are dealing with limitations here in a way that you're not in any of your other books, because you don't have those giant monsters, at least literal monsters. Metaphorically speaking, we can go into that too.
Yeah,
but
sure.
the you are have to rein yourself in, because even though, as you argued in your Scalzi piece, that you don't believe mystery novels to really represent any kind of realism, there is nevertheless a verisimilitudinous plane that you have to meet with this. That there's a little
pretend,
bit different.
They pretend from
to be realistic. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
No, I mean, that's true. There is a limitation, but there's a limitation in all forms. I mean, you know. Genres are both constraining and enabling. Now, one of the things that I wanted when I was writing this book is, it was very important to me that this was a book that did not, that was faithful to crime. That like somebody who was interested in crime, who read a crime novel, would not feel like this is some outsider who doesn't get the rules, who doesn't play fair, who, you know, like I want it to be completely respectful and have total fidelity to that paradigm. And so you're quite right. It does, you know, I can't magic them out of a difficult situation. I can't, you know, you don't have the recourse to that sort of thing. But at the same time, you have other things that are potentialities. Like, I know a lot of readers who, with the best will in the world, without any snobbery, simply cannot proceed with a book once they've had too much of a strong eruption of the fantastic. It just brings down a portcullis in their mind. And it's not a snobbery, it's just a kind of effective reaction. And this book doesn't have that. Like a lot of, you know, I would be happy to give this book to someone who would never read one of my other books and say, you might like this, you know. And so it also offers you sort of possibilities. I mean, you're quite right. It is different. And so that brings new challenges and opportunities. I sound like a corporate, like I'm giving a corporate speech, but it's just more, it's more interesting to, it would be very dull to always do the same thing, you know. So it didn't feel constraining at all. It was because this was the paradigm I was in all the way through, I guess.
Not at all, even with the linguistic restraints. I mean, you don't have the arcane or the Baroque words that you have in the Boslock books, but you do have the invented language. I particularly liked Doppel.
The Doppelgangers.
Thank you.
No, I mean, there's always a few neologisms because I like neologism and I like inventing language, but. It doesn't. I mean, to take the logic of your position to an the logic of your question, I should say, to an extreme. It's kind of like saying, you know, if you think about, you know, if the earlier books are more obviously sort of formally inspired by someone like Lovecraft, and the latter, this one is much more obviously inspired by someone like Chandler. It doesn't really make any sense to sort of say that, you know, Chandler is a constraint, whereas Lovecraft is an enabler.
Okay.
You know, it's just a different paradigm. And there's a certain kind of pleasure you can get from the terse but well-placed phrase that you can't get from the incredibly florid, enjoyable paragraph-long description, and vice versa.
I think you confused the terms of my question here.
I'm sure
I think I'm
I
applying it directly not to you, not to individual authors, because, I mean, you know, here you are, you're playing with different genres, you're going to approach each one with a different voice, with a different set of tools, a different set of limitations, so that's why I bring up this question. Mm-hmm. Do you, China, when you go ahead? It sounds like you don't, but I'm curious, if you're going to alter your voice in some manner, whether it be YA or in this, a detective novel, you're going to probably fundamentally do a few things in advance to prepare yourself for writing. And that's right. What I'm trying to sort of get at here.
I see. Well, all I really, at a conscious level, all I really did was read a lot of stuff. I didn't sort of, you know, sit down and write a paragraph and then try and pare out every third word or whatever. I mean, there was not, like, the first draft of this book was not 800 pages, which I then had to sort of pare down. So at a conscious level, basically the preparation is about reading. Mm-hmm. And it's just about reading and about channeling certain types of traditions. I have a very strong sense of tradition.
Sure.
I have a very strong sense of kind of literary traditions and stuff. So it's about channeling and learning about and situating yourself within that tradition. And I'm sure that's having all kind of ramifications for the writing itself, but that's going on behind my own...
Yeah.
My own back, as it were.
Well, this is interesting because the question is how much do you have to read before you are inside a particular voice, and when do you shake off that influence? Because, I mean, you can't necessarily just be a ventriloquist. You have to find your own particular subconscious intuitive take on presenting particular... and in this case, I would say it's totally different. So where do you start with influence and where do you stop?
I know some writers who don't read when they're writing because they're very concerned about sort of inadvertently picking up tics and stuff, and I mean, I get that, but I don't feel like that myself. Largely because I think the search for originality is largely chimerical. I think it's, you know, we are all, you know, the kind of mucky aggregates of all of our influences. And, you know, hopefully we kind of mulch those down into a kind of soup that is distinctly different from all of its component parts, but is also absolutely, wouldn't exist without those component parts. So I think you're asking me to think about things which go on subconsciously, so it's very difficult to answer, you know. But at a conscious level, like I kind of felt quite quickly, I would say within about 3 weeks of starting to write this, that I had the voice, you know, and I'd spent a few months beforehand sort of steeping myself in crime. But then the thing I'm writing at the moment, for example, because it's a very, very different setting, it's closer in tradition to the Perdido,
yeah,
Scar type stuff, is written totally differently, has a totally different voice. And there doesn't feel like a kind of violent paradigm shift in my head. In fact, for a fair amount of the time, I was writing the two simultaneously.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel like a huge conceptual break. It's because I think if you're enjoying writing something, you're so strongly within that voice at the time it's going on that hopefully up to a certain point you can trust yourself to be doing it, as I say, without thinking about it.
But if you're writing two books at the same time, that's two different forms of momentum that you have to make.
Yes,
to
yes.
That's
an interesting question. I think probably every writer has a different sort of irreducible unit of writing time. Yeah. Like some people can like write a blog post for 2 hours in the morning and then, you know, a short story in the afternoon and then a chapter of their novel in the evening. Now, I can't do that. I admire the hell out of it, but I can't do it. For me, the smallest kind of unit of writing focus is probably 10 days. And so, like, I would get into a particular project and a particular voice for, you know, a couple of days, and then I would focus really hard for, like, a week or 10 days, and then I might get out of that and then shift to a different project. And this wouldn't just be two different fiction books. It would be, like, if I was writing a non-fiction essay or an academic essay or a newspaper article or whatever, I would need, that would roughly be the kind of, the atom of, you know, medieval temporal writing, you know. And so that would be the limitation. So I can't do like one in the morning, one in the afternoon, yeah, but I can do more or less one for one fortnight and then another for another fortnight.
So you have to swap every 2 weeks then?
Roughly. I mean, yeah, these are not exact sums,
yeah,
but in that sort of region, 10 days, two, that sort of thing, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Have you ever tried to cut down the time between two different things, or is that just,
an interesting question, but I haven't because, largely because I tend to be driven by whatever is kind of percolating up most dramatically in the head at the time. And so it would feel very willful to not indulge it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe if I sort of crashingly, urgently had to finish a different project but really wanted to be doing something else, then I might have to do that. But I've never really been strongly in that position.
To what degree does a conceptual framework, like this has a very big conceptual framework, which we really have only just begun to plunge into, how does this aid this momentum that we're talking about here? I mean, if you have like a big, huge lot that you have to plant a house onto, and you have to keep on building a little bit of a room here, a room there, how much does the framework assist you in keeping momentum going? Have you tried to write without a framework like
no.
that?
Or? It assists me a great deal. I mean, the way, and again, this is totally different writer to
sure.
writer, obviously, but for me, what tends to happen generally will be that a book will start with a couple of scenes, a couple of images, and then kind of percolate up from that, and there will be a certain sense of the kind of aesthetic and intellectual. This all sounds incredibly abstract, I'm very aware of that, but this is at a very high level of abstraction in my mind, a kind of aesthetic or intellectual or theoretical set of problematics that are being fiddled with, you know? And hopefully they never intrude so that the reader doesn't feel that they're kind of in the way. Indeed, the reader, if they're not interested, may never even notice. That's perfectly fine. But that for me, like one of the big things for me in any book is kind of realizing what set of theoretical questions I'm looking at. Now, it doesn't mean coming up with an answer, and it certainly doesn't mean turning the book into an argument necessarily.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I'll be sort of writing a few chapters or whatever, and then I'll sort of suddenly, and then I'll start thinking, okay, this, what's coming up again and again here is, you know, questions of theology and eschatology or whatever. And then for me, it's quite enabling to have that sense of a thematic or a set of thematics going on in the background. And for this book, it was, as you say, you know, it was very much this. It's kind of quite a sort of conceptual idea about borders and geography, but hopefully blooded and made very, very literalized so that it doesn't feel like a kind of abstract professorial game. I mean, it's supposed to feel like real places, you know. Sure. But that conceptual framework was very important for me.
Well, in talking about the conceptual framework, I've been really astonished to see that very few people have picked up on the multiculturalism idea in this book. I mean, you have Canada, which is where, of course, multiculturalism came from, it has a diplomatic relationship with both cities.
I can feel many thousands of people around the world screaming at that claim, but let's go with it.
Yeah. But I'm curious to what degree this was intended as a sort of response or even a satirical rejoinder in some sense to the multiculturalism debate that continues to go on and continues to be supported by various people and opposed by other people. I mean, what does this book offer intended as a response or intended as your way of working out your own particular thoughts on this extremely loaded subject? Or?
Well, I mean, the problem with the idea of a book working out your thoughts in any field is that it implies a solution. Mm-hmm. Okay, and clearly that's not something I'm interested in. You know, that one of the pleasures of fiction is that you get to play around with questions without answering them. I would say the answer to that your question is yes, to the extent that I'm fascinated by multiculturalism and it's very, very important to me, and so it's a hugely important kind of paradigm and question in my head. But certainly it's not intended as a satire or a critique. I mean, I think multiculturalism, as far as I'm concerned, is under quite enough attack from a lot of fairly sinister forces that I would be very unhappy if people felt that this was a book that was intended to sort of imply that kind of hermetic sealing of borders of cultural identities. One of the things that interests me is the extent to which a lot of readers, and I confess, sometimes frustrates me, and I can't exonerate myself here. You know, obviously the writer is to some extent responsible for the way their books are read, but there is this great desire among a lot of readers and critics to kind of work out the metaphors, to kind of work out what's like to this, to kind of reduce to a kind of mapping. So there's a desire in this book, for example, to read what the city of Beshel means and what Olkoma means. And so this is a metaphor about the East and the West. This is a metaphor about capitalism and communism. The metaphor about religion and the secular. Whereas in fact, you know, although all those ideas are there, of course they are, because you're dealing with conflict and borders. But in fact, all the way through the book, there's a very deliberate attempt, successful or not, I don't know, but there's a very deliberate attempt to refuse to allow the cities to collapse into that. So, you know, Olkoma is not a communist city. You know, Beshel is not a Western versus an Eastern city. This is where multiculturalism comes in, because all of these cities, these cities are not hermetic. They all have minority groups. They all, you know, they all have a kind of multifarious texture to them. You know, so that, you know, they have minority communities of each other within each other, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's very important to me that trying to kind of depict these cultures realistically doesn't preclude, for example, having a section about Pakistani and Somali immigrants to one of these cities, because this is the world we live in. You know, thank fuck.
Yeah.
You know, one of the great things is that the bullshit about the idea of the sealed off national identity is constantly being eroded, and unfortunately, constantly then being defended, I think, you know, wrongheadedly. So the logic of borders and the logic of the notion of cultural identity is very, very strong. Just like the logic of racism is strong. That doesn't mean it's right. It's a problem. But it's like you don't get to kind of problematize. You don't get to kind of necessarily undermine racism in a book by pretending it's not there. You can take it very, very seriously. So this book takes borders and cultural norms and so on terribly, terribly seriously. But that doesn't mean it endorses them.
Yeah. But
does that make any kind of sense
at all? No, it does.
All?
It does make sense, and in fact, actually, first of all, I will say that the minute that you mentioned that Berlin actually existed in this parallel Europe, you essentially, at that point, I was like, okay, this city is its own accord. And in fact, actually, right, I was good. Tempted to look at the two cities, and of course, the city beneath the city is almost as a kind of Lacan sort of situation, symbolic, the real and the imaginary. Mm-hmm, That's what I looked at it as. So,
but,
I mean, yeah, is that?
But,
I mean,
but you're mean, not, I mean, you know, you're not it. Wrong. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I'm very pro. You know, metaphors in fiction. I'm very pro-metaphoric readings. I'm very pro-metaphoric writing. What, you know, everything I'm saying is not to say, I do not like that thing when people say, oh, you're reading too much into a book. That seems to me to be an unhelpful way in. And absolutely all these resonances are there. All I would sort of insist, and I'm not just talking about my own book, I'm talking about all books, is that they work best when there is no kind of collapse into them. They have to also believe in themselves as literally true. And the more they believe in their own literalism, the better and the more fecund and the more suggestive and the more dynamic will be the metaphors that they spin off. You can trust the human mind to get on with metaphors. It's what it does. It's a factory for processing metaphors. You know, and you want to think about them, great. So absolutely Lacan is in there. For anyone who's interested, there's a lot of arguments about, you know, Agamben in there. There's a lot of stuff about, you know, all kinds of stuff in there. But it also has to be two believable cities with a very unusual relationship with each other and a crime that happens in them.
So what you're saying is the reader can bring whatever interpretation she would like, provided that the reader understands that these are territories that are fluid, while simultaneously representing whatever the reader wants to see in those particular cities. I'm trying to sort of corral what you said earlier about, like, I'm pissed off about people who read my books and want to categorize them to this more liberal kind of interpretation that you're also endorsing in this second answer.
Well, I don't, I mean, it's a bit cheeky of me to be pissed off. I mean, I have to say, you know, people have every right to read any of my books however they want.
But
of course they do.
But you are pissed off here.
Frustrated, let's say. Because what goes along with that is a notion of endorsement. Yeah. So I read people saying, you know, at the end of any particular, it happened with Perdida Station. You know, I don't agree with China Mieville about the ending of Perdida because I don't think that was the right decision. Who the fuck said it was the right decision? Yeah. You know, the characters made certain decisions, and I'm not absolving myself of. There are political and social corollaries of what you write, and there are certain kind of responsibilities there. But that doesn't. But a kind of narrow mapping of an endorsement that it, you know, if your main character does something, you endorse it is just that's crazy. And I think that in terms of what you're saying about bringing any interpretation to the table, I wouldn't go that far because I think that. I'm not an epistemological anarchist. I think that some interpretations are righter than others, and I think some are wrong. So, for all things. So it's not about simply saying, well, you know, however you want to interpret this is fine. Like, if somebody comes to me with an interpretation of any book, including not just my own, and says, here's my interpretation, I insist on my right to sort of say, actually, I disagree with you, and here's why, you know. But what that doesn't mean is that there's one kind of master code.
Yeah.
You know, because the moment you've got that, then the story is subordinated to the quote meaning. And this notion of meaning is very unhelpful. What books do, what texts, they do things. I don't think they mean things, they do things. And they do some things better than others.
Yeah. But I mean that's an interesting notion because that assumes that someone is going to stick rigidly to that kind of codex that you're talking about, and I'm not certain if that's the way that people all that's the way that every single person reads. So I mean I guess are you really objecting to the person who rigidly clings to their particular interpretation of something you write or anybody else writes? That's what you're talking about?
No, no. I mean for two reasons. One is that I have no right to do so. As I keep saying, and I mean I do. You know, of course you're right. If you feel that you've been badly misrepresented, of course it gets your back up. Of course it does. But I do think it's very important and very incumbent on writers to have the humility to back down and sort of shut up and listen and say, you know, these, you may ultimately not agree, but you should at least entertain quite seriously the idea that this reader has spotted something that you hadn't, you know. And I think one of the things that's very, very nice about being as a writer is when somebody points out an interpretation and you stop and you think and you're like, fucking hell, you're absolutely right. Hadn't seen that at all. You're absolutely right. But you realize the logic of it in your own book, you know. So in terms of the kind of master code thing, I mean, I think possibly it's because I'm known to be a writer of the left and I'm not I'm not complaining about any of this. I think it's totally understandable. And the fact that people are reading your books with any degree of seriousness is high praise. It's very flattering. But I think maybe because of my politics, sometimes there's an attempt to kind of decode the texts in a way that in a slightly kind of reductive way. I think what I'm arguing against is not interpretation, but is reduction. You know, I've kind of lost track.
That's fine. But actually, I want to get back to the point you raised about look, the characters did this, and that's why the novel ended. Mm-hmm. This is interesting for a number of reasons. One, I'm curious if you are essentially exonerating yourself from the actions of your characters. Number two, this is very interesting in light of the Scalzi essay, which we kind of touched upon earlier, in which you said that most mystery novels don't end particularly well.
That's not quite what I said. The ending always comes with a disappointment.
With a disappointment.
Which is not the same thing.
But let's talk about how endings work in relation to your writing. I mean, is it a situation where your characters run with the ball and your stenographer and you can't really control it? I mean...
No. I personally don't feel like... I mean, I know some writers are very into the metaphor of being a shaman and they kind of channel the characters and the characters... That's not how I feel about it. And I take full responsibility for the actions of the characters. But your characters... inevitably you are part of all of your characters, of course, but you're not, again, it's reduction, you're not reducible to them. And so, I am, not only am I not saying that I agree with Isaac at the end of Perdita Street Station, I wrote Perdita Street Station in part, the ending is designed, for people who haven't read it, this won't make any sense at all, but I mean, the ending of Perdita Street Station was designed in part precisely to be a genuine moral and political dilemma, genuine in the sense that I had no idea what the right answer was. So, because I could see the arguments on both sides, and it may be that there is no right answer, and so you just have to kind of muddle through and do your own thing. So the fact that Isaac does, chooses a certain action when faced with a certain situation, I understand it because he's a character I created. I hope it is believable that is the decision he would have made. But that doesn't mean, I'm not Isaac. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the same decision I would have made. And I'm not the same person day to day. One change, you know what I mean? Yeah. So your point about exoneration is a very good one. And I don't think that, I don't think that you can exonerate yourself from the kind of ramifications of your texts. But you're not talking about real people. That's why it's more helpful, I think, to think in terms of texts than in terms of characters. Like, for example, if you have a character who, in a book, who, really, really hates cruelty to children, for example, but then you read the book, and in the descriptions of the cruelty to children, there's a creeping unease of a kind of pornography, a kind of reveling in the violence. So even though the character is nominally a goodie and doing the right thing, the text itself may be somewhat creepy, somewhat sadistic in an unpleasant way. And so then the question of whether or not the whether or not the writer is, agreeing with the character is not really the point. The question is the point of what the text is doing, because does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But I'm wondering if that's really a fair accusation to attach to any particular writer. I mean, I've seen this particularly in the last 5 years, particularly in relation to a number of writers as to whether how one describes or one, quote, rebels in a particular type of description, however sadistic or sick. I mean, this has been going on as long as books have been made.
But
I'm not sure if that's really, really fair to essentially go ahead and say, the writer must get off on...
For a start, I should say, I'm not fixated on the idea of, I like a lot of very violent books. This is just an example that came to my head, but let's run with it for a minute. I mean, to have a problem with the logic of a book or the logic of a text or the implications of a text is not to suggest, again, in some reductive way, that the writer, secretly has opinions you don't like. They may be absolutely sincere,
yes,
but it's about the logic. I mean, I can give
But we're talking about the prose, though. That's what we're talking about.
Well, the prose, the theme, the narrative shape, the rhythm. I mean, an example that I've used before and that I, you know, people have argued with me before, and that I stand by, is that, you know, I read The Sparrow. Now, I believe wholeheartedly, I've never met her, but I have no reason to disbelieve that Mary Doria Russell is, you know, absolutely, you know, a lovely person, and, you know, perfectly committed to kind of, you know, gender and sexuality equality and all those things, and would be horrified at the accusation that she was homophobic. Okay, so this is not about what she, quote, really thinks. To me, that book is structured in places by a logic of kind of that I think is predicated on a kind of cultural homophobia, which is the terror of the pathology of anal penetration, and therefore I think it is a text I have a lot of problems with, yeah, in part because I think it replicates that cultural norm. But that's why books are not reducible to their authors.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not accusing her of being a homophobe.
Yeah, yeah. That's,
I don't know her. I've, yeah, not, you know, what I'm saying is that text I think has a certain dynamic in it, and I'm just plucking that up as an example.
Sure,
there's plenty,
sure,
of others. That text has a dynamic in it that makes me uneasy, and that I think, you know, while it's not reducible to her, she's clearly got something to do with it as well, just as we all have something, yeah, to do with all of our texts.
But she could very well be essentially, going back to the stenographer metaphor I presented earlier, she, mm-hmm, could very well be observing something in our culture that is inherently homophobic, and she's putting that into a book, and however unpleasant and uneasy, yeah, it makes any of us feel, it nevertheless represents, it goes back to, I think we're talking about an argument about how much should a novelist make a reader feel uneasy.
No, I'm very pro books that make you feel uneasy. I mean, there's uneasy good and there's uneasy bad, I suppose, to be incredibly sort of foolishly sort of crude about it. I mean, you're absolutely right that it could be that, you know, the depiction of a cultural unease and the channeling of a cultural unease doesn't necessarily mean an endorsement, and that's where the job of interpretation comes in.
Sure.
That's where it's the job of the critic and the reader to be sitting there and to be saying, well, in this case, for the following reasons, I think this, it, you know, is doing the following thing, and in this case, however, I think it's doing something else. And that's, you know, an awful lot of texts disavow their own prejudices. There's an awful lot of texts that will, you know, jump through hoops to tell you how terrible something is in a way that you slowly realize is being focused on in an almost libidinal way,
yeah,
that you get to talk about this thing which you are explicitly disavowing.
Yeah.
In terms of the question of unease, I think unease is a great thing for books, for texts to make readers feel. I'm very pro unease. I'm very pro extreme alienation. But it depends what for, it depends by whom, it depends who is being alienated from what, it depends what the final effects are, and so on and so forth.
There has to be a justification for that unease. Yeah.
Well, I think there is no such thing as like unease as a kind of abstract entity.
Yeah.
I think somebody who feels uneasy about the presence of people of color is doing a very, very different social and political thing than someone who feels uneasy about the maintenance of poverty. I mean, these,
yeah,
are two fundamentally different phenomena.
Sure.
And so unease itself as a category doesn't get you very far, I think. It's, you know, you have to concretize it in each case.
Mm-hmm. It has to be motivated in every single case, you say? You would say that behind every sentence that an author puts down, there must be a kind of, I suppose, a motivation or a reason for that sentence to exist?
Well, there will be a reason. The problem with motivation is it implies a degree of intentionality that I,
yeah,
think is not necessarily helpful, but there will be reasons there. I mean, there's nothing wrong with, I mean, I like those texts that have a kind of very, very radical alienation from the whole of the everyday. We've talked about this before,
yeah,
I think, the surrealist tradition,
sure,
and, which is all about this sort of rampant, radical alienation that problematizes everything. This is, I think, a very fecund tradition. The reason I shy away a lot from questions of motivation is because, not because it's irrelevant or uninteresting, sometimes an author's motivation is extremely interesting, but because this is not a tribunal. This is why I'm much more focused on text than on the intentions of a particular writer, what I really meant, you know, this, that, and the other. I just don't think that's the most fruitful way of looking at texts,
yeah,
you know.
What is the most fruitful way of looking at text? Is it from an aesthetic standpoint, from an emotive standpoint?
I don't think you can distinguish the two. I think texts are, you know, artifacts which are kind of, you know, the intersections of, you know, of our whole culture. They are, you know, thrown up by cultural moments and therefore contain all kinds of shit and all kinds of great things channeled through a particular person who is just as much a product of all that stuff as the text and as everything else. So the idea of trying to kind of focus on one reading, set of concerns or one type of reading just seems to me to be ultimately fruitless, because you know, the separation of the emotional and the aesthetic and the political and the social, this is, you know, we do the job of separating those out.
Yeah. I mean, we're getting into a post-structuralist nightmare, basically.
Please. Yeah, I'm very far from being a post-structuralist. I think it's always about seeing texts as part of totality, social totality.
So for you, when you have a very conceptual idea, like going back to this book, this is, I would argue, a far more conceptual book in the world. And as such, because of the procedural dialogue, some of the emotions have to be hidden within that procedural dialogue. And I think it's very interesting. But this leads me into a question as to what, when you write any particular book, are you aware of this kind of balance between, I suppose, the conceptual, the cerebral, versus the emotive? Because there are often very extraordinary feral feelings in your characters. And sometimes when you have a conceptual construct along these lines, like two cities next to each other, I'm wondering if this interferes in any sense, or if you're aware of any interference between a conceptual angle and the sort of emotive thrust of the characters.
Not in particular, but again, I'm probably the worst judge. I mean, I think in this particular book, I did want the emotion, the kind of emotional life of the main character to be quite muted. And that was a deliberate decision, which again, whether it works or not is a different question, but it was a deliberate decision because I knew that it was going to be written in first person, and I wanted him to be somebody who does not verbalize his own emotions to himself. He does not say, I am happy at the moment, I am sad at the moment, and therefore he wouldn't say it to us either. And so the attempt, the hope, is that you have somebody who you end up with a reasonably strong sense of as a person, but they're quite interior, and you kind of grow to that awareness kind of without kind of necessarily realizing that you've done so, and also realizing that they probably don't have a very strong sense of their own self.
Yeah.
You know, so that opacity was deliberate, but I don't think it was a function of the kind of conceptual background of the book, because one of the problems is, you know, because we've been talking a lot about the kind of, you know, the philosophy and the ideas and the theme, and that's all legitimate in there, but again, as we've said before, I think, my job is to keep people turning pages until the end of the book. If they don't turn pages, then I've failed in my job. And, you know, to that extent, the story cannot be reducible to these ideas. And one of the things in this book is, there are gunfights and police chases and, you know, a crime and, you know, exciting arguments, I hope, you know, and all that sort of thing. And in all the books, you have to be writing to somebody who simply, even the word itself implies a criticism, which I really don't mean, who wants a good story, who wants to be kept on the edge of their seat, who wants to know what happens next, and who may not care about any of this other stuff. And that's not just legitimate, that's the driver. This has to be a story. And as the characters are an integral part of that story, there's a difference between being intriguingly opaque, which is what I hope the main character is, and being flat and uninteresting, which obviously would turn the reader off. Yeah. So I don't think it's a function of the conceptual background. I can imagine the conceptual background of The Scar is very, very strong in my head, but the characters are much more baroquely fleshed out in this book.
To me, it's all about the conceptual background, simply because when the one image in this book that seemed to stick out predominantly for me, and it's the fact that it's an image is important, is Borloo sitting and being aware of that he's a thin man in early middle age, and he's eating his yogurt, and the subway passes him by. And I kept looking for a moment similar to that throughout your book, and I said to myself, Jesus Christ, there are actually no mirrors whatsoever that I can see throughout this entire book. So therefore, it's a conceptual thing that sneaks up on you. You plant an early clue like this, and that, as such, it becomes this opacity that we were talking about earlier. That's why I bring up the question of emotive versus conceptual.
I think that's an excellent, excellent point in this particular book, because because the book, in a way, the lack of talking about mirrors in a book which is all about doubling is precisely that kind of disavowal of the reductive reflection analogy, and also, you know, because mirrors have featured pretty heavily in a lot of my other stuff, absence here is quite... No, I mean, you may be right. I mean, you may have diagnosed something in me that I'm not aware of. I, you know, kind of more or less definitionally, I wouldn't be I wouldn't know. But at a conscious level, no. At a conscious level, I very much wanted him to be quite opaque, but... you know, partly, I mean, I find, a lot of this is Chandler. I mean, I love, you know, Chandler's characters, I end up at the end of the book with a very, very strong sense of them, but they never turn to me and say, you know, I am sad, but I'm doing my best to cover it up or whatever, you know, but at the end of the book, somehow I've got, that's what you're striving for. I mean, if you're going to strive for something, you might as well strive for something as genius as Chandler.
Yeah,
you know?
Trouble is your business.
Was that your trouble? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Down these mean streets.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think on that note, that's a fantastic way to end this. But China, thanks so much for taking the time. It was a pleasure chatting with you again.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Yes.